option number 8224 or roll number 3?
Mr. O'Riordan, reel 3. What effect did this first raid on Elwak have on morale in the unit?
Very good. I think we returned to our base with a very contented feeling of a job well done. And for most of us, I expect, it was the first time we had been under fire, which is always interesting to know how it's going to feel. And of course, it gave us great confidence, the fact that the cars, only one or two were pierced by anti-tank rifles. The one I was in was not, so I came back feeling confident. And we all did.
Before you'd gone on the raid, had you practiced manoeuvring in line abreast and various evolutions and so on?
We probably had, because I remember now, I think we had some flags which indicated, which we could, the man could hold up and indicate to others what he was doing. I can't really remember this in full. It wasn't an elaborate signal system, but there were various flags which you displayed. I can just remember driving about on these armoured cars over the rough ground in time to time in probably a sort of formation, you might say, with the troop leader. After all, there are only three cars in a troop. The troop leader could direct his other two cars quite easily by a simple signal system. I can't really remember anything of that, but we must have had done some sort of training of that nature.
It sounds as though the role had changed from one of reconnaissance and observation to one of shock action.
Oh, yes. We now had, for the first time, some armour to help the infantry. We were we could be a spearhead now, which you can't be in an open truck.
What happened then? What do you remember of the raid on Elwak in December 1940?
On that occasion, one of the other members of the troop drove the car, the armoured car. We had more than enough men in each troop to man three cars. Obviously, we had to allow for casualties and spare crew for other natures. But I went on that excursion in one of the follow-up vehicles. In fact, I think I was with the quartermaster, as far as I remember, in his truck with rations and the stores for the men in the cars. So I didn't see the battle from the front at all. In fact, I really didn't see much of it. I was just there and heard the noise and knew what was going on and saw an aeroplane or two from the back.
Was there a lot of air activity?
Little. But much compared with what any of us had seen before. There was, during the advance, I remember there was this Caproni bomber, which gained a bit of history and came up and dropped bombs quite close to where we were. This was then dark. It was early dawn, but it was still dark. Fortunately, no damage. A fighter plane, which I think belonged to the South African Air Force, or two, were called up. And we were greatly cheered by seeing them chasing this Caproni away, and finally on the far horizon, columns of thick smoke coming from the bomber having been shot down. That was most encouraging. I seem to remember, during the day, a Fiat fighter, Italian plane, came and delivered a sort of attack away from where we were, but I don't think it caused any damage to anybody.
Was the quartermaster's vehicle in which you were travelling in a sort of convoy, a B echelon convoy?
Yes, we didn't come along behind the armoured cars. We came with other software, you might call them, with probably the Gold Coast infantry were there. I can't exactly remember that journey there very well at all. I remember principally being with the quartermaster at the back, and the place where we were all heading for was there was a landing ground, and that was where we were deployed around, and we were to destroy the enemy, who were not far away from this landing ground, and so we were to hold it.
So the landing ground was your forward base for the actual assault.
Yes,
was it?
That is as far as I remember. I remember being just sleeping on the ground in an open on a large open plain there, and it certainly wasn't in thick bush where we were camped. I think the men at the front were in thick bush, but the landing ground was the sort of base of this operation.
You say you had to hold the landing ground. What arrangements were made for its defence?
That I can't remember. But there must have been, because this force that went was called Dick Force and had several columns of it. And there were the Gold Coast Regiment, and I believe some King's African Rifle people may have been there as well. And there were other arms, such as Royal Engineers, I think, came with explosives to blow up the enemy barbed wire defences. I don't remember very much about that, except that I was there. But I don't remember as much as the earlier LWAC action of the previous November, in which I took a leading part.
So you weren't required to go forward as a replacement?
No. I stayed around where I was, and we then eventually went back. We may have spent 2 nights or more away on that occasion.
What was the food like when you went out on these raids?
Well, as far as I remember, there was bully beef, or there were other tin foods. I think there was a thing we called M&V, which was meat and vegetable. And there were army biscuits. And sometimes the quartermaster found the tins of fruit. And we had maize meal, from which we made a sort of porridge at breakfast time. I don't remember eggs. There were always plenty of tea. We unfortunately nearly always had a taste of petrol about it, because our water receptacles were old drums, old petrol drums, and petrol 4-gallon tins. It was easy to clean them out, because once the petrol tin had been discharged, the contents had been poured into the armoured car and only had the vapour left lying around it. You threw a lighted match in through the hole at the top, and it made a whoosh and a bang, but it got rid of the petrol that remained in it. It was then washed out with water, and the water then was reasonably untainted. But most of the time one was drinking tea and water with a taint of petrol in it. That's how we had to carry it.
Did you carry all your water with you?
Oh, yes. Yes, there were no taps or anything there. I never saw any of us ever using any wells. We carried our water with us. In the cars had water tanks built into them, from which we could obtain water, but of course you had to be careful with it, knowing that it wouldn't be refilled immediately when it was empty.
And what about the supply of fuel for the cars? How was that?
A petrol lorry somewhere at the back, and it came in, it was in 4-gallon tins that were known as Debbies, and a case of petrol were 2 4-gallon tins. And it had a round the top, which you pulled off with a pair of pliers or a screwdriver, about the same size in diameter as the hole in a 2-gallon, old pre-war 2-gallon petrol tins with a screw top, that sort of size. And they had a handle which you carried it by, but you didn't ever throw one away or puncture it in any way, because you needed it for your water.
Can you remember what sort of mileage the gallon you could get out of the
I cannot cars? Remember, but whenever we halted anywhere and we were safe, we were ordered to fill up. We had petrol gauges in the car, just like a lorry has. In fact, the chassis, I think, was the chassis of a Chevrolet lorry.
So you were away a couple of nights on the second LWAC raid, and what
could
happened?
Have been. I can't remember at all now any much detail of that.
Did you do anything between the November raid and the December raid? Were there any patrols to do?
I think there must have been. I know we did spend a lot of time sitting around, there's no doubt about that, playing cards mostly and reading books and doing Times crossword puzzles in my case. I used to get the Weekly Times out from England. It took time to arrive, but I had these things sitting around. We must have done patrols, but of course we weren't there to be wasting petrol. I dare say that was a strong consideration. But we must have done patrols. But I don't really remember much about them.
So it just have been a case of driving through the bush.
Yes, along tracks, you see. You didn't go into thick bush in an armoured car because you could be ambushed. The armoured car wanted space around it to see, and it was no use sitting still pretending you were a pillbox, because then the enemy also had time to pinpoint you and perhaps destroy you.
These actions were based at Wajir, were they?
Well, there was a place called Arbo, A-R-B-O, which was near Wajir, which is where our armoured car regiment's, A squadron of our regiment's base was. The other squadrons were away in other parts. They weren't there. I can only speak of my own squadron, A squadron.
I think you said that A squadron eventually moved from Arbo to... Yes. A place called Mile 52.
Yes, now what happened was that after this second LWAC action, which was on the 16th of December 1940, we went on leave, I believe. I find it difficult to remember. We went on leave. I remember being on leave that year for Christmas. And then we came back. Or we may have spent Christmas at Arbo. I can't quite remember which now, but I know we were suddenly told, off you go, on leave. And we then returned to, not to Arbo, we got our new armoured cars. And we, this place I believe is known as Mile 52. I find it very difficult to remember now exactly where it was. Because I've been in other places since. But we went there to prepare for the advance into Italian lands. And...
You mentioned the new armoured cars. What were they like?
They were a proper vehicle. We had... Marmon Harrington was the name. I'm talking now of A Squadron, which had these cars, which I have previously referred to as Susies, armoured with boiler plating. After that, when we came back from our leave, after the LWAC business, we had some armoured cars with turrets, with proper armour plating. They had a Ford engine, from what I remember, and chassis, and had an armour-plated mounting of the body of the car, and they had a turret. And this was something quite in a way different. We had a good field of fire. You could swing your gun all around, and you could shoot out of it without exposing your head and shoulders to the enemy.
Must have been much safer.
It was much safer, and you felt much more secure in it. Now, these cars were issued to us when we returned from our leave after LWAC. That must have been in January, I imagine, of 1941.
Were they still three man?
They were still three man, except the car commanders had four. There was a wireless set in the car commander's car, the troop leader's car. And so we came back from our leave, and we were there at this place, which... whose name, I'm sorry, I can't remember. And we could perhaps look it up afterwards if necessary. Eventually we got the orders to advance.
Could I ask what sort of armament they had?
A Bren gun, just the same as the other ones had. A Bren gun, and I think the car crew each had a revolver.
Did you take any time to get used to the new vehicles? Did they differ in any significant way?
Oh, I think yes. A lorry is a lorry, whatever the body of it is, and one in the driving seat. They were infinitely superior in that they had two gearboxes, like the Land Rovers of today. You transferred into a lower gearbox, and you got four-wheel drive. It would get you out of most muddy and difficult places. They had that. They had an internal mechanism by which you could open and shut the front to let cold air in for cooling, and there was a little water tank inside by which, if you were held up a long time with your front closed and no air getting in, you could pump water from a reserve tank into the cooling system and it circulated round. There were many things like that. It had more space in.
Well, was it a more reliable vehicle mechanically than the...
I don't suppose there was anything in it. I don't remember either of them being particularly unreliable.
So these were just refinements?
Yes, they were superior vehicles altogether.
Were they more comfortable to sit in and drive?
I think they could have been. I can't remember back that far. I mean, an armoured car is an uncomfortable thing at any time. When it bumps about, your head knocks the top. But I wouldn't say that any of them were too bad. After all, we were in the war. We were jolly thankful to have armour.
Did you have any sort of helmet to wear to protect your
head? Oh, no. We wore blue berets. It was the issue. I also had my old slouch hat. I think we were issued with them too. And my blue beret was always just lying beside me somewhere in the car. I took it off to drive. I don't think I took my slouch hat in the car. I can't remember.
You mentioned preparing for the advance. What preparations had to be made?
Well, I think we all had to be assembled in one place, and we had to go on cleaning our weapons, cleaning our vehicles, making sure they were all in good order. I don't remember us actually doing any exercises as such. What I do remember was that while we were in this great camp, at wherever it was, name forgotten now, I'm afraid, waiting for this advance, there was a comet seen, which caused a great stir. And I believe eventually was called Cunningham's Comet, because he was then the general officer commanding. But I remember, I didn't know much about astronomy, but I could recognize stars. And I remember seeing this star. I think the name's coming back. It's a place near a place called Garissa, as far as I remember. Garissa. And one or two nights, after all, we were there with not much recreation, much to do. It was warm and clear skies, and we used to perhaps sit around telling tales and laughing and joking. And I used to look at the stars with one or two other people and wonder what they were. And we saw this star with a tail, and eventually we looked a bit funny, and we got hold of local papers, as far as I remember, and it was a comet. And I think it was referred to as Cunningham's Comet, although I believe at the time, I'm not sure they didn't call it Wavell's Comet, because we were under him from the Middle East Command originally. This was a subdivision of it. Anyway, the comet was there, and people thought it was good luck. Well, in February of 1941, the British troops advanced into East Africa beginning of February. I believe it was the 5th or 6th or something like that. And we were a part of a large organization called the 12th African Division. And we were attached to the Gold Coast Brigade. We'd been with them before, and we were still with them. And now we were the spearhead of the advance, as tanks are used, or were used in other parts where they had tanks. And off we went. By the time we advanced, the others were already been moved. We weren't the first to move on this advance. But we left this place, Garissa, I would say at about the middle of February. And off we went in a northeasterly direction, heading towards Mogadishu, I suppose, which is the capital of Italian Abyssinia. And we had some scraps on the way. I seem to remember there was a place with some name like Afmadu. I can't quite remember now, but there were skirmishes. And fortunately, nobody got hurt on our side. I don't know whether the other people just fled. Anyhow, we then came up a few days later to the Juba River, which was crossed, as far as I remember, first of all, by the Nigerians. And then they managed, when they formed a bridgehead on the other side, pontoon were rigged up, pontoon bridge, and barges, floating ferries on a wire probably, and we crossed in our armoured cars. We crossed this Juba River.
Had you actually been under fire yourself during the advance up to
that? No, not that I remember. I don't remember it at all, being involved personally in any action as I had been at the first Elwak show.
But you were still driving a car?
Yes, I was driver of the car.
How was the advance actually conducted? Did the cars go ahead of the infantry or...?
Not at that point, because the great thing was that the armoured cars could not cross the Juba River, which was the great obstacle, without the infantry getting there first and making pontoon bridges or something of that for them. Anyhow, there was no... we weren't in front then. Our turn to be in front, of course, came later. Well, we crossed the Juba River on this pontoon bridge, and shortly after, I don't know how many days afterwards, anyway, there was a scrap ahead of us. There was a place called Jelib, which I remember the name very well, and we were to attack this place. And this was towards in the last week of February, might say. We had quite a scrap there, I remember. There was a landing ground at this place, Jelib, and we whizzed round it, firing at the enemy positions on the far edge of the landing ground. But this was mined, this landing ground, and four of our vehicles, I think, were disabled by them, including the mine. We didn't know, us in the car I'm talking about now, I thought at first that we were under artillery fire, because I saw these other cars, explosions going off on the ground apparently alongside them. I thought it was shells landing, and I thought perhaps we were on a targeted area, and they just waited for us to arrive there and open fire with these guns. So I was reluctant to get out of my car. We wanted to get out of the car for fear another shell arrived. I was reluctant to get out at first, because in the confusion and the dust and the banging and the crashing of this mine, I couldn't find my hat, and I was very anxious not to get sunstroke, which I knew was very important in the tropics. We all had to wear hats by tradition. So my fellows got out, and then someone shouted out that it was mines, so there appeared to be no point in getting out of the car. I had to wait there as a driver until the... I can't remember the name of them now, but there was a department which looked after the broken down vehicles came along. Light Aid Detachment, I think it was called, the LAD, the Mechanical Light Aid Detachment. So eventually I went in to Jelib, which we had captured as a result of this action, being towed by a lorry. And on the way in, I remember this mass of stuff, equipment, and it appeared to be quite a lot of Italian Navy seemed to be there. I don't mean the ships, but men in naval uniform who'd presumably come up from Kismayo, which is at the mouth of the Juba River. Anyhow, there was quite a scrap there. We didn't have any men killed. Our squadron leader, who had only one arm already, a regular soldier, got a bullet in the other one when he was getting out of his armoured car to try and prevent the other armoured cars going on to what he had immediately diagnosed as a minefield. I remember that incident quite well because I saw it happening from my car. Well, eventually we camped down there. My vehicle, I forget what happened. I suppose some sump or something was blown out underneath. Anyway, it couldn't be driven. It was repaired. And after a while, then we were on the move again.
Can I ask you a bit more about this action? When you were attacking the enemy positions on the far side of the airfield, what sort of formation were you in?
Well, we were this A squadron, say, has three cars. Well, I think we moved off the road following the squadron leader. Yes, we had, I'm not sure we had more than three cars there that day. We must have had another squadron, or we had the regimental the squadron headquarters with us, and they had their own vehicles. I know we were more than three. Anyway, We followed our squadron leader. A squadron would have three troops, of course. There'd be nine or ten cars. We followed him, more or less in single file, and then fanned out, as far as I remember. So we were all firing at the enemy. Well, then we couldn't go any further because we'd been in the bush where we were vulnerable. So we swung round and came back and did a half circle and went round again, really, until all the firing seemed to cease from that particular area. So the infantry could get ahead. The infantry couldn't get ahead until we'd cleared these men off the edge of the airfield, because they couldn't go across country there or along this road with their lorries, or on foot for that matter, without us to clear them off first.
So you were driving past the enemy and firing on the move, were you?
Yes, we were firing on the move the whole time. We were driving up to the area where they were known to be and from where the small arms fire was coming, and firing into it. And the man at the gun turret could perhaps see more than I could, who, after all, he was standing up. I was sitting down. And he fired where the fire seemed to be coming from. And then we were all doing this, all the cars. Four of them, as I said, were blown up at various stages, mostly when they were heading back. We then were heading back actually to regain the road, to lead the advance on into this place called Jelib, when I drove the thing over this mine unwittingly.
Was it a very powerful shock when the mine?
Yes, there was a bang and a lot of. The man at the gun saw better than I did that these other cars getting it. And I said, there must be artillery, as I've previously said. And then we went over along, and he said, now we've had it. And there was this great... There was a lot of dust came into the top of the car, after all the turret was open, you see. And I think I had suffered a headache for the rest of the day, but it wasn't really damaged in any way. I was rather angry at being sitting there in a disabled car when I could have been whizzing along being the first man in Jelib.
Were the mines... anti-tank mines, or were
it was thought that they can't have been really anti-tank mines because they did so little. Well, they damaged us in the sense they put us out of order. I didn't really know technically the difference in anti-tank and any other form of mine, but I assumed that these mines, because of the smallness of the bang, comparatively speaking, that they were perhaps directed against infantry advancing on foot, whom they would have certainly done harm to. They did harm to us in that they delayed us, but these cars were soon mended. I can't think they can have done a great deal of damage to a tank, but that's only my own personal opinion based on ignorance.
Did you see anything at all of the Italian positions or of the enemy?
Oh, I saw one or two chaps running and scurrying, and I shouted out to the gunner that I was going to try and catch him up or in the car. And he said, no, don't be a fool, because you won't be able to knock him over, you'll sidestep your... Some jokingly words of that nature I remember very clearly. But the only other people of the enemy I saw then was after we'd captured the place, all pouring in to surrender, including the gentleman I saw in naval uniforms.
Were they Europeans or were they native?
Mostly Europeans, but the natives naturally accompanied them, the higher ranks, the other people, may have vanished into the bush for all I know.
Well, what was the demeanour of these prisoners of war?
I think they were just a bit astonished and probably relieved. I mean, don't forget, I didn't have any personal handling of them. I merely saw them from the wheel of my armoured car, which was at that stage being towed along by a breakdown lorry.
What impression did you get of the town, Jelib?
I can't remember. It wasn't much of a town. It was just a settlement, I would say, really. Italians must have had an administrative post there or something of that sort, but I just remember it was a place name, and there were probably some stores run by Indian traders or Arabs, probably a marketplace, and probably quite a large native settlement. Don't forget, we were there, you see, in a territory which is notorious for nomadic.